Hello and welcome to episode 106. The main focus of this instalment is to look at Arthur C. Clarke's 1975 novel, Imperial Earth. Of the three novels which Clarke published during the 1970s, this one is easily the least known. However, it has returned to some degree of prominence thanks to a recent reissue by Galanx as part of their SF Masterwork series. The book is worth a look for its utopian leanings and Clarke's tentative examination of sexuality in science fiction. I've covered Clarke quite extensively before. You can listen to my views on The Sands of Mars in episode 88, Earthlight in episode 4, A Fall of Moondust in episode 67, and The Hammer of God in episode 59. For the first time, this episode has another bonus component. Stay tuned for a brief look at the first five books in Roger Zelazny's fantasy series, The Chronicles of Amber, which were published between 1970 and 1978. They're one of the main pillars on which Zelazny's reputation rests today, but perhaps they shouldn't be. For me, they increasingly fall apart after a very promising first instalment. I've covered just one book by Zelazny before, his influential post-apocalyptic novel Damnation Alley, which I much preferred. To catch up with that, seek out episode 54. As ever, text versions of all these reviews are available at andyjohnson.xyz. It is 2276, and the Earth is a utopia. The population is only half a billion. Crime and conflict are things of the past, and what we now call rewilding has taken place on a planetary scale. To Duncan Mackenzie, this world is a deeply strange and confusing place. He's a scientist administrator from humankind's outermost colony, Titan, the largest of Saturn's moons. Accepting an invitation to celebrate the quincentennial of the United States, Duncan visits Earth for the first time, and must also handle sensitive business of his own. Imperial Earth is the second of three novels Arthur C. Clarke published in the 1970s. Two of these novels are widely acclaimed classics, well known today. Rendezvous with Rama, from 1973, is famed for its sense of wonder and won five major awards. The Fountains of Paradise, from 1979, popularised the concept of the space elevator, and won both the Hugo and Nebula Awards for Best Novel. Despite Clarke's high hopes for it, at one point he thought of it as the big one, Imperial Earth did not reach these heights. It won no awards and eventually fell out of print, where it remained for some time. The novel has returned to print, and today Imperial Earth joins Clarke's other 1970s novels in Galanx's authoritative SF Masterworks collection. In his introduction to this edition, SF author Stephen Baxter mentioned some of the book's interesting themes. These include its greater emphasis on human relationships, its focus on economics, and Clarke's position as a technophilic optimist. Imperial Earth is not a particularly plot-oriented novel. In 2010, Joe Walton summarised its plot as "What I Did on My Summer Holiday," which is not entirely unfair. By 2276, humans have solved most of the long-standing problems on Earth and have spread across much of the solar system. The frontier is represented by Titan, the inhospitable moon of Saturn, which is the most distant world occupied by humans. Titan is critical to the system's entire economy because it's a prolific source of accessible hydrogen needed to power spacecraft. It's also the dynastic fiefdom of the Mackenzie family, who founded the colony and control the hydrogen supply. Duncan Mackenzie is a third-generation clone. He is a clone of his father, Colin, who himself is a clone of Duncan's grandfather, Malcolm. The three of them and their respective families largely run Titan, but are conscious of the economic threat represented by the new asymptotic drive, which consumes far less hydrogen. When the family receives an invitation to Earth to celebrate the 500th anniversary of the founding of the United States, Duncan is selected to attend. Duncan travels to Earth aboard the spacecraft Sirius, along with over 300 other passengers. While the Mackenzie clan intend to sincerely celebrate the quincentennial, Duncan has additional motives for the trip. He plans to seek out former lovers, Kalindi and Carl, and to organise the creation of his own clone as a means to secure his family's future. While on Earth, Duncan must acclimatise himself to a world he's never visited, and which seems deeply alien to him. He also finds himself trying to understand the motives of Carl, which might provide the seed of a different economic future for his own world. The future presented in Imperial Earth is very much in keeping with Clarke's usual style. The setting is free of conflict and broadly unencumbered by serious problems. War and crime are things of the past. The Earth's environment has been revitalized and safeguarded, and humans have colonized much of the solar system. In terms of setting, then, the novel shows how little Clarke's style evolved over the years. With just a few changes, Imperial Earth could be made into a sequel of sorts to Earthlight from 1955. It could just as easily be set alongside a much later book like The Hammer of God from 1993. In all of these books, Clarke presents peaceful and prosperous futures made possible by great strides in technology and understanding. Part of the pleasure of reading them is that in each one, Clarke speculates about different aspects of near-utopian future worlds. In Imperial Earth, this includes discussions of a worldwide communications network that resembles the internet, the reintroduction of forests and threatened species, and a human population that spread more thinly and harmoniously across the system. Imperial Earth is also notable for its emphasis on human relationships. Like many other SF authors of his generation, Clarke was not particularly adept with characterization. In his books and stories, people are engines of plot and spokespersons for ideas, rather than fully formed personalities. By contrast, Duncan Mackenzie does have something more of an inner life. His relationships are also a significant part of the book. For example, he has a strong link with the estranged former wife of his clone grandfather, who works on geological problems in seclusion on Titan. There's also an element of sexuality to Imperial Earth. Prior to the novel's events, Mackenzie was in a kind of polyamorous relationship with both a man and a woman. In this sense, the book is somewhat groundbreaking and fits within the context of greater sexuality in science fiction in the 1970s. However, Clarke is very coy about these subjects, just as he was in discussions of his own real personal life. Much more is implied than ever really stated. Truly frank discussions about sexuality in SF would be left to bolder authors like Samuel R. Delaney. Imperial Earth is an interesting SF novel which fits neatly within Clarke's wider body of work. It's not one of the author's most important books, however, and certainly pales in comparison to its immediate predecessor, Rendezvous with Rama. A number of its themes, such as cloning and environmentalism, have been explored more thoroughly elsewhere. What Clarke does do in the book is to combine these themes into another of his cohesive and concise explorations of a better world. The strongest part of the novel is arguably its finale. In keeping with Clarke's style, it's based not on heroic action or a momentous event, but rather on an inspiring speech. In his capacity as a representative of Titan, Mackenzie speaks eloquently to an audience of millions about humanity's place in the universe. Clearly, the protagonist is being used as a mouthpiece for Clarke's own views, but this knowledge does not diminish the power and hope of those words. In this way, then, the speech is a microcosm for Clarke's work. Stay tuned for our bonus feature on the Chronicles of Amber novels by Roger Zelazny. Roger Zelazny, who lived from 1937 to 1995, made his name with a series of acclaimed works of science fiction in the 1960s, which included the novels This Immortal from 1965 and Lord of Light from 1967. These earned him the Hugo Award for Best Novel twice inside the space of 3 years. Critic Olgis Budrys said of Zelazny's first story collection that the author was, quote, beginning where other famous people have arrived. The success was all the more striking given that Zelazny was not a full-time writer. For much of the 1960s, he was working as a civil servant for the US Social Security Administration, and his writing time was limited to the evenings. It was only in 1969 that he felt able to leave formal work and take up writing full-time. Shortly afterwards, he began to publish a lengthy fantasy series which came to be known as The Chronicles of Amber. Eventually extending to 10 volumes by 1991, the series began with Nine Princes in Amber in 1970. This short novel introduces the small but powerful Kingdom of Amber, which is ruled by a dynastic family given to ruthless infighting. The consequences of their sometimes deadly scheming are potentially vast because of the family's unique abilities. Amber is the only true reality. The family can journey between, and perhaps create, an infinite variety of parallel worlds that they call shadows. Nine Princes in Amber is by far the strongest of this first cycle of five books. It introduces Corwin, a prince of Amber who's initially stranded in one of the insubstantial shadows, which happens to be our contemporary Earth. Worse, he's confined to a private hospital and suffers from amnesia. Selaznyi uses this well-worn narrative device to cast Corwin as an audience surrogate. Justly paranoid, he bluffs his way to a dawning understanding of the violent family struggle emerging around him. Selaznyi's first entry in the series moves at an excitingly fast pace, setting up the framework of the distinctive setting. As his memory gradually returns to him, Corwin proves to be an entertainingly offbeat protagonist. He's cruel, but with a streak of compassion he's picked up during decades spent on Earth. He also has an amusing tendency to deploy Chandler-esque hard-boiled dialogue for the same reason. Nine Princes in Amber is rightly seen as a fantasy classic. Unfortunately, the high standard does not last into the four sequels, published over the course of 8 years. Chronicles of Amber grows to seem increasingly haphazard and unplanned. The later entries lack a satisfying structure, either as individual novels or as parts of a whole. The third book, Sign of the Unicorn, is largely devoted to a tiresome relitigation of events that occurred in the opening instalment. The final entry, The Courts of Chaos, serves mostly to set up the second cycle that Selaznyi wrote in the 1980s. In her introduction to Galanx's recent omnibus edition, Ros Cavaney explains that Selaznyi was influenced by his enthusiasm for English Renaissance drama and for Philip Jose Farmer's World of Tears series. Arguably, the author was also indebted to Michael Moorcock's Elric series. Selaznyi's characters and settings have numerous similarities to Moorcock's work, but he lacked the British author's ability to sustain interest over the course of a series. On the evidence of the first five books in the Chronicles of Amber, it seems that Selaznyi's talents were better applied to one-off stories. Thanks for listening to this episode. You can find more of my writing in text and audio form at my site andyjohnson.xyz. You can also find me on Twitter at andyjohnsonuk, and you can support me at patreon.com/andyjohnson. Catch you next time.